hubbardradio.com.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Power of Attorney, an educational program focusing on legal developments affecting businesses and individuals. And now your hosts, the attorneys from Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman.
Good morning, and welcome to Power of Attorney. Power of Attorney is brought to you by Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, a full-service law firm with more than 50 attorneys located in Reston, Virginia, serving clients in the D.C. metropolitan area and across the country. You can learn more about Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman on the web at www.ofplaw.com or by giving us a call at 703-218-2100. I'm Dave Zangrilli, and for those of you who don't know me, I practice exclusively in Virginia in the area of family law, or what some people call domestic relations. So I represent spouses who are going through a divorce. I draft prenuptial agreements for people about to get married, and I handle custody, visitation, and child support cases for parents who have children but were never married. For the first half of today's show, I'm going to discuss the process by which assets and debts are divided in a divorce. In the second half of today's show, I'll be joined by real estate appraiser Kim Bradley, who will talk about the very fascinating topic of how homes are appraised. Virginia is what we call an equitable distribution state. It's not a community property state. You know, every state is different in some regards. Community property states such as California tend to divide all of the assets and debts 50-50. In an equitable distribution state like Virginia, the court is given the authority to do what the judge thinks is equitable, which essentially, of course, means fair. So the judge can divide all of the assets 50-50 or 60-40 or 90-10 or whatever percentage the court deems to be fair. The process is a three-step process. The first step is the classification of the assets and debts. The second step is the valuing of the assets and debts. And the third step is the actual division, who keeps what. So I'm going to talk for a moment about the first step, which is the classification step. In Virginia, we have either separate property or marital property. Separate property is any property that you owned prior to your marriage. It's any property that you acquire after you separate from your spouse. And it's any property that you inherit during the marriage. It's also gifts. So if you receive a gift from a third party, that is a separate asset, assuming, of course, that you can prove that the gift was made solely to you as opposed to both you and your spouse. If spouses give gifts to each other, you know, Christmas time or birthday or what have you, those are not considered separate property. Those are considered marital assets. Let me give you an example. A 401k is probably the best example. So let's say I get married and I have $50,000 in my 401k at the time of the marriage. Then during the marriage, I contribute, let's say, $100,000 prior to the separation. The $100,000 is marital. The $50,000 that I had prior to the marriage is separate. And then, of course, any appreciation, gains, losses, dividends, etc., on the separate portion are separate, and on the marital portion are marital. Now, there's also one third category of property besides separate and marital, which is called hybrid property, which is what it sounds. It's hybrid. It has some marital components and some separate property components, which really would be the 401k that I just described in my example. Commingling is a very common occurrence. Commingling is when you commingle separate properties and marital properties. And I actually wrote a 30-page legal seminar on this topic, so I could speak for probably 3 hours on this, but I won't. But suffice it to say that people often commingle their separate property. They may have $50,000 in the bank when they get married, and then during the marriage, they start depositing their pay into that account. They start making withdrawals or writing checks from that account to pay for living expenses. And money is going in and out and in and out of the account, and it really becomes hopelessly, jumbled up and commingled. And that's a way where separate property can lose its identity as separate and really be transmuted and become marital property. For certain assets, most common the house, you have this problem. either where it's a hybrid asset or it's been commingled. You know, in a common situation, I own a house prior to the marriage, which has a mortgage. And then during the marriage, you know, my spouse and I are paying the mortgage with marital funds, with monies that we're earning during the marriage. And sometimes we maybe make, you know, large and expensive repairs or improvements to the house. So then the question is, well, how much equity is separate since I own the house prior to the marriage? And how much is marital since we did make contributions during the marriage? There's a formula that the court's not bound by, but many of the probably all of the judges know the formula. It's called the Brandenburg formula. It's named after a case that I think came out of Ohio. And again, it's not binding on the court, but it's usually at least a starting place where essentially you reduce the contributions to percentages. You look at how much principal was paid prior to the marriage, you know, how much was the down payment, how much did the owner of the house reduce the principal prior to the marriage. So you have that chunk of money. Then you look at how much principal did you reduce during the marriage, and you convert those to percentages. And then you multiply the percentages times the equity in the house to find out how much is separate and how much is marital. That way, if a person owned a house prior to the marriage and the house appreciated in value during the marriage, you know, that person, that owner, has a claim to some portion of the appreciation relative to his or her, you know, premarital contributions. Now, of course, there's always two ways to skin the cat in an equitable distribution. Sometimes the person who is trying to assert that a certain piece of property or a portion of property is his or her separate property simply can't. They don't have the documentation. You know, they may have owned a house 15 years ago prior to the marriage, and then the house was sold, and they took all of the sales proceeds and rolled it into the purchase of the new house. Well, they may not have all the documents from 15 years ago. Maybe the settlement company is not around anymore, or they can't even remember which settlement company it was, and they don't have the HUD-1 statement. They don't have their bank account statements from 15 years ago. They'll testify as to what they contributed. The other spouse may testify, you know, that that's not the case, that the that particular spouse is lying. So the judge may not be able to, specifically find, here is how much of this piece of property is separate. You know, I, as the judge, can't say that 47% of this house is separate and 63% is marital, or 53%, I should say, is marital. But when we get back to the final stage of the process, the division stage, a court could say, well, clearly this spouse contributed significant premarital monies to the purchase of this house. And even though he or she can't prove the exact dollar amount, you know, I feel bad for the spouse. So instead of a 50-50 division, maybe I'll do a 55-45 division, or 60-40, or something to that effect. So there's always two ways to skin the cat. But I will say that if you're a spouse trying to prove a separate property ownership or a component to an asset, it really is a forensic exercise. You have got to have all of your documents. You've got to go back and reconstruct the past and show all of the bank statements, show money going in and out, so you can provide the judge with a clear paper trail to prove that these monies were your separate monies prior to the marriage. In terms of the classification step one, titling really does not matter. It doesn't matter if an asset's titled solely in one spouse's name or if it's titled jointly. The only reason that titling matters is because if an asset is solely titled in one spouse's name, the court cannot give that asset to the other spouse. So say I own the house solely in my name and we purchased it during the marriage. It's clearly a marital asset, but it's titled solely in my name. If we were in trial, a judge could not give that house to my spouse. They can, of course, give my spouse 50% or whatever percentage of the equity in the house, but they can't actually transfer the house over to my spouse. So that's why titling is important. And of course, when you're classifying assets, debts work the exact same way. Any debts that I owned prior to the marriage are separate. Any debts that I acquired during the marriage are marital. Even if it's in solely my name, it's still a marital debt if it was incurred after the date of marriage. All right, so that's the first step. That's the classification step. The second step is the valuation step. Once the court decides which property is marital and which property is separate, the court has to make a ruling as to how much the various assets and debts are worth. The court uses the date of trial to value these assets. They don't use the date of separation. They use the date of trial. Equity is what matters. It doesn't matter that your house is worth $3 million. If there's a mortgage of $2,700,000, you only have $300,000 of equity in there. So equity is the only figure that matters when you look at homes, when you look at cars, when you look at any asset that's encumbered with a mortgage or with a loan. Some assets are easy, obviously. Bank accounts, you know, you just, whatever the value is. Oftentimes, though, for other assets, you need to hire an appraiser, such as a house, such as personal property. You know, what is this television worth? I don't know. You have to hire an appraiser to value that. And the same things with businesses. You have to hire a CPA or a forensic valuator to place a value on that business. And same thing with cars. Usually you can go to the NADA or the Kelley Blue Book and get a value off of that. The final step in the process is the division. And there's lots and lots of factors that a judge is required to consider when distributing the property. 9 out of 10 times, it usually shakes out to a 50-50 split. Oftentimes, it's more expensive to litigate it than it's worth. You know, parties say, well, I want 65% of this for X, Y, and Z. And the reality of the situation is that the client will spend more money in legal fees than they're fighting over. That's a very difficult pill for people to swallow in these situations, but it really is the truth. You know, when the judge looks at these various factors that the court is required to consider, such as each party's monetary contributions to the marriage, each party's non-monetary contributions to the marriage, whether monies were wasted during the marriage, so on and so forth, usually the judge arrives at a 50-50 division. Sometimes the judge will, you know, award most or all of the assets to that spouse, but then make that spouse pay the other spouse, what we call a monetary award. Pay them their 50% share or whatever share. We're going to take a short break now. Please stay with us. I'm Dave Zangrilli, and you've been listening to Power of Attorney, hosted by Odin Feldman and Pittleman. To learn more about Odin Feldman and Pittleman, find us on the web at www.ofplaw.com or give us a call at 703-218-2100.
You're listening to Power of Attorney with the attorneys from Odin Feldman and Pittleman. Learn more about legal developments affecting individuals and businesses when Power of Attorney returns in a moment. A Legal Minute.
Hi, I'm John Frieden with your Legal Minute. Successful e-commerce businesses invest a great deal of time, effort, and money developing their websites. Though these websites may be among their most valuable assets, e-commerce businesses rarely think to fully protect them. A successful e-commerce business is likely to attract imitators, who liberally borrow website content to drive their own sales. In too many instances, an e-commerce market leader finds itself suddenly beset by competitors who have been able to implement their websites quickly and easily by using content taken from the market leader. An e-commerce business can protect the original content of its website and reduce the risk of loss associated with this sort of imitation by archiving the website regularly so that the website owner can demonstrate exactly what was on the website at each particular point in time, and obtaining a United States and foreign copyright registrations of appropriate material. For more information on this topic, go to powerofattorneyradio.com and click on Legal Minute.
Welcome back to Power of Attorney, an educational program focusing on legal developments affecting businesses and individuals. And now your hosts, the attorneys from Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman.
Welcome back to Power of Attorney on 1500 AM. I'm Dave Zangrilli, and in the studio today, I'm happy to welcome Ms. Kim Bradley. Kim is a certified real estate appraiser in Virginia, Maryland, and D.C., and is also a licensed real estate broker and appraisal instructor in Virginia. She is the owner of Marquee Properties, Inc., with a staff of 12 appraisers providing appraisal services in Virginia, Maryland, and D.C. for nearly 15 years. Good morning, Kim.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Thanks for being here. Tell the listeners, how did you get into the appraisal business?
My sister's actually an appraiser, and I had just had a baby and was looking to do something from home and with my own set hours, and it worked out perfect for both of us. Since then, my mom has joined the industry as well, so it's very incestuous, but we enjoy it very much.
And I would imagine that it does provide flexibility in terms of, I mean, obviously you probably aren't going to be going over to folks' home at midnight, but it does provide you with flexibility.
Yes, it does, and it's very nice, but it's one of those sort of jobs that you never turn off. It's the phones are always ringing, the emails are always dinging, so it's we keep very busy.
Certainly know that feeling. And what type of training does one need to become an appraiser?
Well, there are different levels of licensure to be an appraiser. You start off as a trainee, which means your reports have to be signed off by a certified appraiser or higher. Then you can be a licensed appraiser, meaning you can do properties under $1 million. You can be certified like me, and you can do properties over $1 million, or a certified general. You can do pretty much any property, including commercial. So each level has its own 2,000 hours for licensed, 2,500 for certified, and up from there. And then there are the required appraisal courses that are required for each one of those levels as well. Currently, as a certified appraiser, you're required to have an associate's degree. In 2015, that'll change to a bachelor's degree. And as a certified general, you're already required to have a bachelor's degree. So they're becoming more strict on the requirements to become an appraiser.
Oh,
before,
great.
Everybody just kind of jumped into it, and now they're toning back on that.
Yeah, I was an NFL agent once, and it was the same thing, where pretty much if you had a third grade, you know, degree, you could become an NFL agent. And luckily, they changed the rules for that. You mentioned trainees. You know, I've, in my line of work, I've received appraisals before, and every once in a while I see the trainee and then, you know, the more senior appraisers, you know, signing off on it. How long is one normally a trainee?
2,000 hours is the minimum, and that's within no less than a year. And now the rules are that the actual appraiser signing off must inspect the property with you. Lenders are generally not allowing the trainee to go by themselves. In the olden days, that's how it was.
Right.
Certainly all of my appraisers were trained that way, where you did their, you know, 2-3 month, whatever it was that they needed, and then set them off. Now, no, for those 2,000 hours, they have to usually go with you. So it's making it a little more difficult to actually break into this business because of that.
And I've heard the term REO. What is an REO?
That's a real estate owned property. It's just another term for a foreclosure. So if someone didn't pay their mortgage, the bank took it, it becomes an REO property.
And what effects are REOs and short sales having on the appraisal process?
Well, that depends on the market and the type of appraisal you're doing. So if I'm doing an appraisal for a purchase of a property that's an arm's length sale, meaning it's not REO or short sale, and you're in a market that doesn't have a tremendous amount of distressed properties, probably not going to have a whole lot of an effect. Some subdivisions just full of these, and you can't ignore them. They're clearly driving the market. They're competing with arm's length sales, and they're going to be unavoidable to use as comparable sales. So it really depends on the market. Now, we do appraisals for Fannie Mae. We do them for Wells Fargo and some of these banks that require us to use REO in short sales because they want to see what's going on in a particular market. So when I say it depends on the type of appraisal also, we could be doing it for that purpose, and then we're using those sales to determine a value. So yeah, it just depends on the scope of the appraisal.
So if you're in, if you own a home in one of these neighborhoods that have a lot of short sales and or foreclosures, it really affects the value of your home, even if you have $500,000 of equity in it.
Absolutely, absolutely, because lenders do have certain guidelines they want you to follow, and a lot of times that means including a sale from the neighborhood. And when the predominant sale isn't a distressed property, it's likely going to bring your value down.
Now, you have your finger on the market a lot more than I have. Right now, our foreclosures, have they slowed down a lot, or are we still seeing a lot of those?
We're still seeing some. The prediction is that in beginning of 2014, we're going to see a whole new wave of them hit the market. I think banks are less likely to do short sales now. They lose more money during the short sale process, so they're tending to go to foreclosure, and they anticipate us seeing a new wave of them. That's not necessarily a bad thing. Fannie Mae, for example, will come in, they'll put new carpet, new paint, new appliances in a property, and these properties sell basically at market value. Hmm. It's the ones that are sort of run down and need a lot of love that are affecting things. But Fannie Mae is actually doing a good job of selling their properties at market value.
And let's talk about the appraisal process itself. What do appraisers look for during the inspection?
Well, that's the easiest part of what we do. And people get upset because they're like, oh, the appraiser was only in my house for 15 minutes. You know,
I've heard that complaint many times.
Yep. I've been doing this for so long, I can pull up in your driveway and I already have a sketch in my head of what it's going to look like. So we are required to go around and sketch the entire property and measure it. They either use a measuring tool on the outside of the property, a tape measure, or I use a laser pointer on the inside. We are required to measure your property. Take pictures of every room. Make a note of what the flooring is. Is it well maintained? Have you done any updates to the property? Do you have granite countertops? We're looking for an overall appeal of the property. And then the appraiser should ask you questions. When did you update your bathrooms? When did you do your kitchen or your roof? And these are all things that are going to go into the overall condition of the property when the appraiser's there doing the initial inspection, which, again, is the easiest part of what we do, not the beforehand, the research that we did and the after of doing the actual reporting of the appraisal process. So,
and I see these reports all the time. They're, I don't know how many pages they are, 15, 20, 25 pages. How long does it take to actually sit down and generate one of those reports?
From start to finish, it should, you know, because you've got driving time in there of taking comp photos and things like that, probably 5 to 6 hours.
Okay.
On a fairly easy one. It can, you know, you start getting into $1 million properties, obviously that time's going to go up.
And you've probably seen some interesting situations with divorced couples where you're having a hard time getting into the house, or they're both there and they're making the situation uncomfortable, I would imagine.
Absolutely. We could write a book on the things that we've seen, actually. one of our appraisers went to court last Monday for a divorce, and it turned out great. You know, the husband had an appraisal done, and that appraiser used bank sales. Actually, only used 3 sales on the grid to all total. 2 of them were bank sales that were more than 6 months old versus us using all 90-day sales in arm's length. And obviously, we came up with a $60,000 difference.
Nice.
And the judge chose our appraisal, so it was good.
Fantastic. And do lenders have guidelines? And if so, do the guidelines kind of vary by the lender?
Oh, they certainly do. Once our housing bubble burst, things changed considerably for appraisers. Our appraisals are now generally ordered through appraisal management companies. And they have sometimes 20 pages of requirements, and it is really crazy. We refer to it as scope creep, meaning they want us to do all of this. It does not affect the final value of the property. They just want all this extra sketches and pictures and fluff in the appraisal. We don't get paid anymore for it because they get to take their cut of it. So that can be a whole nother show, talking about appraisal management companies and how they're affecting this industry. But yeah, they certainly do have guidelines. It's not like the olden days where you could cherry pick your comps to make value. They have strict guidelines. They want sales within 90 days. They want sales within the same neighborhood. They want you to bracket all features, meaning if you've got a 3-bedroom, 1-bath home, you better provide a comp that's a 3-bedroom, 1-bath home. They don't want to see all colonials to compare to your Rambler. So definitely very strict guidelines. And they do vary by lender. Some are easy, some are hard. And that's our job to keep straight when you're at an inspection. Who am I doing this for? Are they the ones that want pictures of every room or sides of the house or the interior of the garage? It's very different than it was several years ago.
And what happens if there are no good comps? What happens if in a particular neighborhood there hasn't been a like sale in a year or something like that? Are you allowed to use those comps?
Generally, we try not to go past a year for comps. Fannie Mae frowns upon that very much. So if it's a truly unique feature, like we did a 13,000-square-foot house in Great Falls last week, we had to go past a year to find a 13,000-square-foot house. They just don't find those every day.
Mine's only 12.5, so you couldn't use mine.
So there are instances, but if you can't find a like comp, then you expand and you find comparable neighborhoods where there might be a sale that you need. That's why in 90 days or has an in-ground pool or whatever that feature is that you're trying to get on the grid. So there will always be something that you can use. You just might have to expand time or distance to do so.
Gotcha. Is the process different for FHA loans versus VA loans versus conventional loans?
Determining the value of the property makes no difference what the loan type is. The inspection process is what's different for an FHA or a VA loan. They have a little stricter guidelines. We go in, we check the utilities, we flush toilets, we look for leaks. Safety and health hazards are really their biggest thing. Lead-based paint in homes built prior to 1978. So the inspection process is different, not how we determine the value.
And I used to hear when I first started practicing that appraisers use different standards if it was an appraisal in terms of determining the value, if it was an appraisal for a refinance versus if it was a purchase or sale. I mean, I never heard any – that was never substantiated from me, but I always would hear it through the grapevine.
Purchase and sale, not so much. That's the same criteria. You start getting into other things like divorce appraisals that could be retroactive to a certain date, or an estate, same thing, retroactive to perhaps a date of death, something like that. But the process with you determined value, whether it's a purchase or refinance, really should be the same. However, keeping in mind that you do have a copy of this contract in front of you, you clearly have ready, willing, and able buyers and sellers – involved in this transaction that say they want to pay this amount of money for that particular property. So there sometimes can be justification for that. And there is a creative process that's involved in this. It's not all math.
Right, right. And obviously we know about, you know, that appraisals happen for divorces and refinances. But what other situations would someone need to have their home appraised?
We do tax appeals, which is always interesting because every county has their own set of rules for the comparables that you can use. We do pre-listing appraisals. So you've got a seller who says their house is worth $900,000. Their agent says it's worth $500,000. So they hire an appraiser to come in and say, really, you're probably closer to what your agent thinks it's worth.
Right.
So that's generally what we do as far as on the private side would be for pre-listing purposes.
Okay. And do you ever get lobbied by a realtor or by an owner to skew the appraisal in a certain way?
Well, back in the day, all the time, that would be the loan officers at that point, which, of course, since the inception of Dodd-Frank, that's changed considerably. It's one of the good things that came out of that. And yes, we still get lobbied. It's still perfectly fine for an agent to leave a package for an appraiser with their suggested comparables. Same with the homeowner. Hey, I know Bob down the street sold their house for this. That's perfectly fine. But to say, hey, I need $500,000 or my loan isn't going to work.
Yeah,
that's so much. That's frowned upon now. And we try to stick our fingers in our ears and go, la, 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 I didn't hear that.
And tell our listeners, what are some of the best ways people can improve the value of their homes?
Obviously, kitchens and bathrooms are going to be your best bet. Putting granite in, putting cherry cabinets, putting in stainless steel appliances, nice flooring, you know, stay away from the laminates, put in nice hardwood floorings or these upgraded ceramics they have now. You're going to get your most bang for your buck there. Is it going to be what you paid to put it in? Probably not. But that will be your best bet. I find that people say, oh, I just put a new roof on my house. Well, it was a 30-year-old roof, so you kind of needed it.
Right.
Just to make yourself in the standard of what the other houses are in the neighborhood. So it really needs to be those significant current upgrades. And then look to see what people are doing now. Try to and not use some of the older materials that were popular maybe a couple years ago.
I mean, on average, I know every house is different, but if you have my house, for example, it was built in 1985, and the kitchen, unbelievably, is still the original kitchen. It has one of those stoves that still has the clock where you turn the handle. It reminds me of my grandmother's, and I chuckle every time I see it. My wife and I, it's ridiculous. But so in a couple of years, we're going to, once the kids are a little bigger so they don't constantly destroy the cabinets as they're currently doing, we're going to replace the kitchen. I mean, if we spend $50,000 on a kitchen upgrade, how much is that really going to increase the value of the home?
It's hard to put a dollar figure on that because obviously any adjustment that we make in the appraisal process is extracted from the market. So we would look at like properties that are updated versus ones that aren't, and then you extract what someone is willing to pay for an updated kitchen. But generally speaking, you're probably looking at 50 to 60% of what it's going to cost you to put it in there.
Okay, that's good to know. What about swimming pools? Do those increase the value? Do those decrease the value?
It depends. Those are difficult, especially in our market. You have to think we only get to use them a couple of months out of the year. I have an in-ground swimming pool. Above ground, you get no value, first and foremost. So, not going to happen.
Right.
In-ground, it depends. If you have an 8,000-square-foot lot and you stick an in-ground pool in the backyard so it pretty much takes up your entire backyard, probably not going to help. Stick that same swimming pool on a property with an acre, you're going to get some value out of it. So it depends on the location. You have a neighborhood that has swimming pools as part of their homeowners association, probably less value than one that's out in the middle of the country that doesn't have access to those things. So it really depends on the market.
And what is the biggest, in your opinion, waste of money that people spend, which really doesn't increase the value of their home?
Landscaping.
And I have a
friend who's a landscaper, so I'm sorry to say that, but it really... And what I say to people when they tell me and they give me their laundry list of every bush they've installed, that they die. Bushes die. So although it may help you with your curb appeal when someone comes up and they're going to pick your house because it looks so nice in the appraisal process, just nothing we can do as far as that. So that's probably the biggest waste of money.
Kim Bradley, thanks so much for coming on the show today. If our listeners have any questions on anything that you've discussed, how can they contact you?
Please call our office. Our phone number is 703-754-7945, or you can check our website out, marquerealestate.com.
Why don't you spell Marquee for the listeners?
MARQUEE realestate.com.
And if you are interested in these issues or any related issues, please visit OFP's family law blog at virginiadivorceandcustodylaw.com, or you can email me at david.zangrilli@ofplaw.com. Thank you for listening. Please make Power of Attorney a regular part of your Saturday morning and check out our website at www.powerofattorneyradio.com.
You've been listening to Power of Attorney with Odin Feldman and Pittleman. Power of Attorney will be back next Saturday morning at 10 a.m. right here on 1500 a.m.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of of Federal Community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.